Hello and welcome to or welcome back to Colonial Outcast. Today we're going to have a relatively brief yet important chat about the Israeli defense complex, which, yes, includes not just weapons, but also drones, spyware, etc. So once upon another lifetime, I was a United States Army Ranger, and I field tested plenty of mostly useless gadgets, which American defense contractors like Raytheon spent tens of millions of taxpayer dollars developing while pocketing the change. But we've never really used Israeli equipment, though. So only over the past couple years have I become familiar with Israeli companies such as Smart Shooter or Elbit Systems. And only then, because our own problematic police forces employ their technology and our own military is now placing bids on their contracts. So here to further educate us all on this subject is Anthony Lowenstein, an independent investigative journalist, filmmaker, and co-founder of Declassified Australia. He's the author of the worldwide bestseller, The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. It was released in 2023, the link for which is in the video description. So the book is a global investigation into Israel's endless occupation, which gives the Jewish state invaluable experience in controlling an quote-unquote enemy population, the Palestinians. It's here that they have perfected the architecture of control using the occupied Palestinian territories as a testing ground for weaponry and surveillance technology they export around the world. That's a synopsis for the book. So thanks so much for carving out 30 minutes to come and talk about this subject. Yeah, and so I think most Americans are generally motivated by self-interest, just like most people. So I'm trying to spread the message that this Israeli tech that controls occupied Palestine will eventually be used by domestic law enforcement here. For example, Elbit Systems surveillance tech is all over the Texas-Mexico border, like near where I live, and it's already starting to creep inward to be used domestically on our own citizens. And of course it eventually will. Do you believe that's a
absolutely
reasonable supposition, I assume. So we're going to open on action and play an advertisement from Elbit Systems loitering munition drone. I.e. it gets close to a target individual and explodes. Notice how it's marketed. The narrator has an American Hollywood voiceover accent. The actors have the same accent. They are in multicam, which is a U.S. Army camouflage pattern. They are fighting in a blasted war zone that looks uncannily like Gaza. So I'm pulling up this dystopian fever dream real quick. It's like a minute and a half, and then we're going to dive right in. All right. There we go.
Patrolling the south quarter, entering a cul-de-sac.
I just want to let you know, the audience, that's not how military radio etiquette works.
We are getting hits. Send the Lanius.
We've got like a drone mothership, if you're just listening to the audio, launching a quad drone.
Attack in one. New innovative autonomous lethal solution based on racing drones. The Lanius conducts GPS navigation, flight scanning, mapping enemy detection, and lethality in a complex urban environment. The Lanius is equipped with AI technologies that allows navigation to building, scanning the building to identify openings, scanning and mapping, object avoidance, enemy detection and classification, target incrimination by human and lethality. The system indemnifies blocked openings and can perform ad hoc lethal ambush.
All of these enemy characters look like cookie cutter global war on terror vision of terrorists. And now they have the emotional, sentimental music because the Lanius has saved American lives. Okay, sorry. I can only take so much of that.
I've watched a lot of those videos. Wow.
Yeah. So that's I'm sure you have that. And just for all you watching or listening, that is what's sent to military contractors or people part of the military. And, you know, they'll take Senate appropriations and bid on entire shipments of Lanius drones or provide further money for further research and development for contracts. So, yeah, how would you like to open this up?
Yeah. Look, I think one of the things that should be said really initially is that for a lot of people watching or listening, they are probably, because they're decent humans, outraged by what's been happening in the last 5 months in Gaza, the destruction, the genocidal violence, the dehumanization of Palestinians. And I obviously share that view. But I think in another sense, it's important to understand, and this has been the case long before October 7th, that so much of what Israel has been doing in Palestine for so long, the West Bank, Gaza, and elsewhere, is to essentially have a major part of their economy of weapons and arms and surveillance and repressive tech. And even though there are many, many countries now, not particularly powerful ones, that have been critical of Israel since October 7, the Arab world, for example, it's pretty clear that, just taking the Arab countries as an example, none of them have cut ties with Israel and none of them will. No matter how much violence is inflicted on Palestinians, I would argue why, and I talk about this in the book, that in the last years, virtually every single Arab state, UAE, Bahrain, Saudi, pretty much all of them, have made huge arms deals with Israel, buying the most sophisticated repressive and surveillance tech from one of the world leaders, Israel. And therefore, they can be critical rhetorically, as they have been. We're outraged by the violence, the war should stop. It's all bollocks, because they are doing that for domestic concern. They know many Arabs in Arab countries are upset, angry, rightly so. But they want to maintain that relationship with Israel. And just as an example, in 2022, the latest figures we have for Israeli arms sales, we haven't got the figures for last year yet, we'll get them shortly. 24% of 12.5 billion US, Greg, were Arab countries, Arab autocracies, 24%. Now, that's only going to increase, because all these Arab states are petrified of their own people, petrified of another Arab Spring. The Arab Spring was in many ways a disaster for a range of reasons, but they're petrified of their own people. And therefore, to protect themselves against their own people, they want to buy the most repressive tech. So I just say that as an opener, that so much of what Israel is doing in Gaza is not to simply test weapons. I'm not saying that it's like saying the US went into Iraq and Afghanistan simply to test weapons. That's nonsense. However, in Iraq and Afghanistan and frankly in Gaza, battle testing weapons is still a key part of what both the US and Israel are doing.
Yeah, and not to mention Ukraine has been one of the biggest weapon testing sites. So I was wondering if you could, in broad strokes, kind of describe how this process works. I mean, it doesn't have a start and end. It's cyclical. It's like research, development, testing, new contracts, bids, new conceptual, and it just goes around and round.
Yeah, look, one of the reasons I wrote the book, The Palestine Laboratory, really was to show people and explain how the longest occupation in modern times of Palestine, more than half a century, with no end in sight, in fact, it's deepening, has become a key place where Israel has developed over decades massive amounts of tools and technologies to maintain that occupation and control Palestinians. Talking about the West Bank, Gaza, so in the modern era, drones, spyware, biometric gathering tools, a range of other technologies. And that's bad enough for Palestinians in Palestine. But increasingly in the last, well, frankly, half a century, but it's increased this century, Israel then exports that as so-called battle-tested to massive amounts of nations. So I'm talking about everyone from Hungary to India to Bangladesh. It's easier to find countries that do not buy Israeli tech than ones who do. It's the majority of nations on this planet have bought in the last half century some form of repressive Israeli technology, a weapon, a drone. And it's not just repressive states, it's many so-called democracies too. And I guess I wanted to explain to people, again, this book came out before October 7, although it's kind of exploded globally since, because although the book's not about that event, it's giving people a lot of understanding and context about how the hell we got to this moment. So really, I guess I'm showing that a decades-long occupation for many, many nations around the world. Even those who might criticize Israel at the UN or elsewhere actually is seen as a positive, because those nations want to get tips and technologies how to repress their own people. And I guess I write this also as saying, as many parts of the world, the global far right and the right is growing. Talking about parts of Europe, India and elsewhere. And the war in Gaza, the war on Gaza, call it whatever you want, is not seen as a negative for these people. In fact, it's a positive. For them, and this has again happened before October 7, but it's increased since, Israel is the model. Israel is the model because many, many nations around the world look to Israel and are saying, yes, we want to buy your technology and your drones and whatever, but actually we also want a piece of learning. How do you get away with it? How do you get away with doing this? Because there's no sanction on Israel. Israel's a unique case for 1,000 reasons, backed by the US, the Holocaust. There's lots of reasons why Israel in some ways is quite a unique nation historically. But many nations want to understand how Israel gets away with this long before October 7 and frankly since. And Israel's happy to try to teach them that.
Yeah, especially I lived in India for a while, and going through Kashmir, I definitely saw that. The Indian, the BJP and the militancy within the Indian army looking to that and like, how can we replicate this in Kashmir, use it for a testing site and do it to all the rest of the Muslims.
And it's interesting, kind of say briefly, you know, just about that relationship. The book has quite a big section about India and Israel, because most people don't really know about it. India is obviously now the biggest country in the world, the biggest self-described democracy, although I would question how democratic it is. You have a increasingly Hindu fundamentalist regime, exactly not that democratic at all. Modi's about to face re-election, almost certainly will win for a third term. And although India is doing what it's doing for its own reasons, it's not doing it because of Israel, many Indian officials for years have openly said, we view Israel as a model. It's not subtle. We see what Israel's doing in the occupied Palestinian territories as a model. We want to do something similar to our Muslim population in Kashmir, as you say. And even literally in the last month, there's been stories in the Indian press. This is again, not my words, the Indian press words. There's been increasing farmer protests in India. They're suffering economically. They're protesting on the streets. And India has been using drones and dropping tear gas to try to disperse these protesters. And the model is Israel. They openly are saying that senior members of this state in India had gone to Israel about 4 or 5 years ago, seen what Israel was doing against Palestinians in Gaza during the so-called Great March of Return, came back to India and said, we should do the same here to any critics of ours. And this really is how the Palestine Laboratory is exported, that very many countries come to Israel and they are watching with admiration what Israel is doing, and they bring it back to their own state. So the India-Israel relationship, apart from India buying massive amounts of weapons every year from Israel, I think is a really dangerous, as I say in the book, the growing loose alliance of ethno-nationalist regimes, of which Israel and India are the key ones. And India's got, 1.5 billion people? So it's not like a nation you can really ignore. I mean, it's massive and growing, and yet it's becoming a deeply fundamentalist state. And the prospect of genocide against the Muslim minority there is a real one. And much of the West, including your country, as you'd know, turns a blind eye because, well, they're not China. The end. And that's disturbing.
No, yeah. In fact, you could say they're already past the initial stages of genocide in India. They're constructing detainment camps. The precursor to genocidal language. Actually, it's now in like legislation, like genocide incitement speeches throughout all of that. And they've been inflamed.
Hugely. And in fact, within the Indian press and Indian government, there's been huge amounts of support for Israel. There is a population in India that supports Palestine. I should say about a month ago, I was in India for the Jaipur Writers Festival, the biggest writers festival in the world. Actually, it's got 450,000 people. It's kind of an insane annual event. And I was there speaking about my book and Palestine. And I'm not suggesting that all of India is represented there, because that would be a lie. But it's fair to say that there was a lot of support within that space, and it's not exactly a tiny space, for talking about what's happening in Kashmir. And so many Indians came up to me afterwards and said privately, we cannot say this here. And I'm not saying I'm some great champion for talking about this, but I'm saying a lot of Indians said, we cannot say this publicly because if we do, we could be literally kicked out of the country. We will have some bogus tax investigation that, you know, involves us for years. And increasingly, there is no free speech in India around Kashmir, Hindu fundamentalism, Israel, Palestine. So, yeah, India and Israeli alliance is something that more people should be aware of.
No, and again, there's a lot of like neocons that are just anti anything like China. Everyone's like looking to Taiwan, and that's beyond the scope of this conversation. But a lot of powerful factions see that as the next flashpoint for who knows what. And that being said, I'm sure some Israeli tech is being used in that part of the world too, especially with Taiwan. We now know that there are special operations forces in Taiwan operating certain drones, certain surveillance equipment as well.
Can I say one point on that? It's interesting. You know, something often I think about and is that the US and arguably really Israel as its key ally, although often I wonder in the last 5 months, who's the superpower here? Is it America or Israel? But that's a separate conversation. Like, who's in charge? In theory, it should be Israel because they're the ones doing it, and yet the US is sort of willfully hapless about actually trying to stop anything because they don't want to. But it's worth saying that pretty much for really half a century, neither the US or Israel have won a war. They're actually incapable. Now, I'm not saying that inverted commas winning Iraq and Afghanistan would have been a good thing. Don't get me wrong. But they're actually incapable of beating an insurgent force. They cannot win a war. Israel has not won any war for decades, neither has the US. That doesn't mean they don't cause mass carnage in the process, but I think when the US, as you'd know very well, Greg, talks regularly about massively expanding defense budgets, think to yourself, but you're actually incapable of winning anything. You can cause carnage, and the US is very good at that, as is Israel. But as war increasingly becomes fought between major powers and insurgent forces, yes, China, God help us, if there's some major war between the US and China, and will no doubt involve Australia as well, unfortunately, that's a slightly different case. But no one would honestly say that the US is likely to win that because they're actually incapable of doing so, right? That's what I think, seeing on my experience with both the US military and Israel. And that's a disturbing state of affairs because that fact is too rarely mentioned in the mainstream press, as if somehow we've just forgotten about Iraq or Afghanistan, which was in most people's recent life, as you would know.
Right. And I always try to make this distinction. There are many ways to conceptualize different types of warfare. So US and China, even US against the Iraqi army, under Saddam, that was third generation warfare. It was symmetrical. There was a Navy, there was an Air Force, there was an artillery corps, there were infantry battalions. You know, of course, they were outmatched by the United States' spending, budget, force, deployment, logistical capacity, and a lot of other stuff. But it was still symmetrical in a way. It's completely asymmetrical here. And what you need to do in order to fight an insurgent force is to occupy territory. That's just going to breed resistance. And especially the way Israel is fighting. You can't do it because they're going to care way more about your land than a guy who's got like, I've got one deployment left, then I'm going to college to get laid, and
except,
I'm freaking out of here.
Except, let me just say the caveat to that. I mean, I agree with you. However, as many viewers will be aware, what Israel is doing in Gaza arguably is not really about demolishing Hamas. I mean, yes, that's the stated aim. And obviously, yes, they could militarily degrade Hamas quite a lot, which they're no doubt doing. I think that's probably inarguable. But the plan is, in fact, to level the place, to make it unlivable. And therefore, it leaves Palestinians with very few options, including friends of mine who were trying to get out because people who would never want to leave, who are saying, how do we have a future here for our families when there's nothing left? And as some viewers will be aware, the plan for many within the Israeli military and political elites, and frankly public, is some kind of indefinite occupying force. Because when they look at what's happening in the West Bank for decades, most Israelis see it being cost-free. I mean, it's delusional, but they see it as relatively cost-free. It's sort of out of sight, out of mind, literally down the road. And if the similar vision, which I fear it is, backed by the US, the EU, and much of the Arab states, is to do something similar in Gaza to the West Bank the day after this war ends, it is, as you say, guaranteed to lead not just instability, but more violence against, I would say, Jews, including myself, around the world. Everything Israel is doing is making things worse, not just for Israelis, which is a given, although it's not often said, but for Jews. It's making all of us more unsafe by this indiscriminate slaughter, which is not making anyone safer at all. It's lunacy, absolute lunacy.
No, I mean, it strikes me that Israeli policy uses the Jewish diaspora hugely as human shields in some way, because I feel like an actual rise in anti-Semitism only fuels their own militancy and increases it.
I was just going to say that, I mean, the book doesn't hugely talk about this, but I've written about this issue a long time, about the, I call it the radicalization, really, of not just Israeli Jewish society, but the global Jewish diaspora. Obviously, there are growing numbers of young Jews, especially, who are speaking out and critical, so it's obviously not all Jewish people. But much of the Jewish establishment in the US, UK, Europe, certainly within Israel itself, with a handful of very brave dissidents and critics, some of whom I know, who are doing amazing work in journalism or activism, but they're a tiny minority. That the radicalization of Judaism in the service of endless occupation, the weaponization of anti-Semitism in the service of brutalizing Palestinians, in the deluded belief that that's somehow going to bring you security or safety 80 or so years after the Holocaust, is not just delusional but dangerous. And that, you know, to the point where the Anti-Defamation League, this self-described Jewish organization that the media obsesses over, as some viewers will be aware, in the last few years, Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the organization, has come out and said regularly, he's been saying it since October 7 as well, there is no difference between a white nationalist and an anti-Zionist. So you think, right, okay, so you're honestly arguing that there's no difference between me as a Jewish anti-Zionist and a white nationalist that goes into a synagogue and shoots people up. Really? There's no difference. This is where this hardline militarism is taking the Jewish establishment, and it's dangerous and historically immoral. And this is why I'm happy that the only silver lining in all this madness in the Jewish community in the last, well, frankly, half a century, is growing numbers of Jews are speaking out, particularly younger Jews, 18 to 35. And you've seen that in parts of the US. Since October 7, Jewish Voice for Peace and other groups that have been amazing. They're a minority. They're a growing minority, and I'm happy about that, because the majority position is so immoral. It doesn't matter if Israel killed 50,000, 100,000, 500,000 Palestinians. The vast bulk of the Jewish establishment would be by Israel regardless, going with them as they drive off a cliff. This is where post-Holocaust hardline Jewish nationalism is taking us, and it's disastrous.
And they're not going to get a lot of pushbacks from these governments for a whole bunch of reasons, but focusing in on the defense complex, they have a defense relationship that they are relying on, that they don't want to give up. And I try to make for like laymen or into this people just stepping into this world, it's reductive, but it's like, okay, the United States will sell you the best tanks and the best fighter craft, but they control the supply of repair parts, and the fancy equipment requires a lot of repair parts. So you piss them off enough, we'll just cut the repair lines and you can not have an Air Force in 3 years. So it's also a diplomatic mechanism of control as well. And, making it harder for a country to challenge Israel.
Well, one of the things I talk about in the book is that I see the Israeli arms industry as an insurance policy. And what I mean by that is that over decades and decades and decades, Israel sold so much repressive surveillance tech to so many people, either for money, for votes at the UN, for a range of reasons. And it's pretty clear, even after October 7, that the only real countries that I can think of that has openly said that they will not buy Israeli weapons, at least for the moment, is Colombia and Spain. Now, I'm sure there are others and I may have missed some, but in general, most of the nations that have bought repressive Israeli tech will not stop buying it, even if they've been critical of what Israel's doing in Gaza. So that insurance policy was born after 1967 and the Israeli victory of taking over the West Bank, Gaza and East Jerusalem and the Sinai, where they realized that many countries around the world did not like the occupation, did not like what they were doing to Palestinians, but were so quick to transfer that experience so to speak, of occupying Palestinians, to the point where, and this is part of the history in the book that a lot of people, I think, have been astounded by, the US backing repressive states post-World War II is more known. The Israeli backing of it is virtually hidden, not because of some conspiracy, but just less known. So people don't realize that when the US was backing Pinochet in Chile and Guatemala in the 80s and Iran, and all Iran before 79, all these repressive states, Israel was usually there with them by their side, providing training and weapons and surveillance. And as you mentioned before, you know, the reason why Israel often wants to get into these states is also to have access to surveil those countries, to sort of know what they're saying, what they're doing, what they're thinking, how they might vote, how they might vote at the UN, etc. So the challenge really, I think, after this war ends, is there needs to be a number of states that openly say, we impose arms embargoes, like what happened with South Africa. This will not end with words. I don't mean, you know, words alone. We are long past people being upset with what Israel is doing. I mean, long past that. And this was the case before October 7th. So, yeah, the Israeli arms industry, I think, after this war is going to thrive. In fact, I don't think it's going to suffer at all. In fact, it's the opposite. I mean, just to the point where last week, and there's so many examples I could give, there was a major story in the in Haaretz, which is a Israeli newspaper, talking about how robot dogs often bought from the US is now being hugely tested in Gaza. Now, that's been on the US-Mexico border for a while. Increasingly, and that's been exaggerated, of course, under Biden. And as you would know very well, Greg, and maybe some viewers here, anyone who really believes that the immigration policies of Trump were so much worse than Biden actually don't know what's going on. I mean, Trump is uniquely awful for a range of reasons. It's not a defense of him. But in the last 3 years, as you'd know, because you're closer than I am, so much of what Biden is doing on the border, yes, there are Israeli surveillance towers, amongst other technology. Biden is deepening that surveillance, deepening all that. It's not changing at all. And in fact, whoever wins in November is only going to make that high-tech surveillance even worse.
Yeah, I mean, and now it's there's so many things that are just completely transparent. Biden gave a call last week for Trump to, like, work with him on securing the border. It's like, I think a lot of Americans are frustrated that it's the same party, but I keep getting asked, like, bombs are being tested. It's like, no, the bombs that we're going to use for the next 20 years are already developed. They were developed like a decade ago, like these GBU 2,000-pound bombs. They've been around since Desert Storm and before. What's being tested now? Drones, surveillance equipment,
yes, cybernetics. And like things like quadcopters, which have been firing. You know, it's just basically a drone, an armed drone, essentially. There's been lots of testimony of Palestinians and doctors in Gaza saying they're seeing injuries they've never seen before, which is a pretty common. Also, there's been no foreign reporters to go in there, but there's been huge amounts of testimony from Palestinians and doctors who have gone in and out. Yeah, this is what they're testing. And robot dogs and robot is not just surveillance, but also potential weapons. And you can, and AI-enabled warfare, as some viewers will remember in the last months, there's been all these stories about Israel's using AI-enabled warfare, something they're calling the gospel, which is ironic to put it mildly, to essentially, so they allege, go after Hamas militants. But actually the goal, as both my sources and a couple of Israeli journalists who I really respect are hearing, the aim is mass destruction. It's not to pinpoint target so-called terrorists. And you can see what's happening in Gaza. The place is being flattened. And many nations, believe me, are looking to what Israel's doing now with admiration. They're not going to say it publicly, looking at it with admiration, saying in months and years to come, we want a piece of that for our own conflicts. AI-enabled warfare, killer drones, whatever it may be. This is how the laboratory works. And Israel is using, again, it's not the main reason they're doing in Gaza this. It's not simply to test weapons. But it's a pretty important side project and a key one because the Israeli economy is suffering a little bit because of the war, unsurprisingly. And, you know, after the Russian invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago, huge amounts of European states came to Israel begging to buy all this missile defense shields and other kind of weapons. And Israel's been selling all that to country after country, Germany, Finland, and others. That's not going to change. I mean, the Russian war of Ukraine is still going on, hasn't ended, and won't for, I fear, a while. So the Israeli arms industry, and now with Gaza, I think is in a pretty good position to, tragically, I mean, I've done a lot of work over the years about disaster capitalism, a book and a film, which was not about Israel-Palestine, but this is what this is. It's making money essentially from misery. And although many in the global left, call it whatever you want, are outraged with what's going on in Gaza, and rightly so, there are many, many others who look to it with real admiration, tragically.
So going forward, it's going to be the marathon of demanding boycotts for Israeli arms. I mean, I know this Friday I'm going to be disrupting, pissing off Raytheon at South by Southwest and their trade show. I've got my own personal beef with them from my military experience. So just settle in. That's what we're going to be looking at. So I think thanks so much for coming on here and, you know, breaking down the basics of it. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Thanks, y'all, for listening, and we will see you in a couple days. See you later. Cheers, y'all.